had dragged by her foot up close to her own when Patterson cleared his throat and began unfolding a wad of yellow sheets he had fished from his back pocket. "Palmer Henry," Palmer was saying, "a pleasure to meet you, Marcus." Her hand, so far in the man's lap, he had to suck in to shake it. Velma had to smile, while Ruby took it right on out by muttering, "Well, all right, sister," which drew enough mumblings and giggles to drown poor Patterson out. "That's roughly the intro to my first public speech," Patterson was saying, sadly refolding the papers since Riley had dropped his head down and wagged it in disapproval. "And now, ladies, we'd like your input regarding..." "We just got through telling you about this input shit, Jay," Ruby said, louder than was necessary. A groan from Daisy Moultrie's mother was sufficient to stop him. He looked from the women to the men to the visitor, hoping some message about decorum might get read. He turned to Lonnie and the younger men, and then to Riley and the older men, waiting on someone to clear the air so the meeting could take its course. "I think," Daisy Moultrie's mother began, scooting to the edge of the sofa to plant her pumps neatly on the carpet, "that we need to table the agenda and take up an item you yourself, Jay, have been trying to make us attentive to. Namely, it is time we formalized this organization, elected officers, drafted a charter, and put ourselves on the public scene as an official group."
"Right," Ruby interjected. "No more hastily called meetings and 5-minute commitments and unilaterally drawn up agenda items. If we're gonna deal, let's deal."
Velma felt her sister's fingernail gouging her arm. She hoisted herself up carefully and prayed the makeshift sanitary napkin would not dislodge itself.
"Now, before we proceed," Velma said, "we need to be clear, all of us, about the nature of the work, about how things have gotten done in the past, and why that pattern has to change."
"Don't be so damn polite," Ruby interrupted. "It boils down to this. You jokers, and especially you," cutting her eyes at Lonnie, "never want to take any responsibility for getting down. Mr. Riley accepted. Now, what that has meant in the past is that we women have been expected to carry the load."
"Well, I for one," Patterson said quickly, darting his eyes nervously about, fearful of the impression this was bound to make on Marcus Hamden of the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists, "have always been most appreciative of your input, most grateful for the work that you ladies have done, most..."
"Insensitive,"
Velma said, fairly hissed, wishing Portia Patterson were in attendance and might be bold enough to say in this gathering what she eagerly said about her husband in the privacy of her kitchen.
"Not a clue, my friends, as to how the eggs, bacon, and biscuits come to appear before him every morning. He makes up lists, see, of all the things he wants done, and posts this list on the refrigerator door, just like there were little kitchen fairies and yard elves and other magic creatures to get all these things done."
Velma was thinking. Abstractionist summed him up. A perfect label for the habit, the unmindful gap between want and done, demand and get. And abstractionists make good bombardiers, good military beasts, she was thinking, wanted to say, but Palmer had warned her not to get metaphorical, to just speak to the issue and to speak plain so they could adjourn and Palmer could pack to get on the road.
"To put it bluntly, Jay, how could you still have the nerve to be talking about running?"
Velma demanded. "We've been over this ground before.
and 3 times we explained to you that if you refuse to relocate, to move back into the county, you simply can't run. It's hard enough trying to sell your lackluster self and non-existent record to folks. Add to that the fact that you never do a bit of work, put up a bit of money, or ever are prepared to do or be anything but a garden variety ambitious careerist. Plus, you're not even a resident, Jan inserted.
Well, in regard to relocating, Patterson was trying to keep his face under control. I thought I made myself quite plain.
You are always quite plain, and there's the rub, turkey.
It's simply out of the question, he continued, ignoring Ruby. Further, it's not necessary. There's no law that says I have to live within the county line.
Is,
Old Man Riley murmured, his head dropped onto his chest.
Or convention, mayhap,
Lonnie amended.
I'll look it up.
Page 672, paragraph 1, lines 4 and 5, Jan was saying, tilting a fat blue book from the upright stacks on Patterson's desk and sliding it down the table, rattling ashtrays, coffee cups, and Patterson.
The issue, Jay, Velma continued, is not simply your persistence in the teeth of law and convention. She nodded toward Lonnie. But the fact that it's just a definitive example of the egocentric way decisions are made in this group and why we need to establish some policy right here and now.
Well,
Patterson was muttering, leaning up out of the book and taking off his glasses.
It's probably true that residents in town would...
But do you have any idea of what you're asking? To rip up my roots?
Roots? In the suburbs?
Ruby was laughing, slapping her thigh and rearing back in her chair.
Nigga, please. That township was incorporated long after you got out of law school.
You did get out of law school.
The Moultrie women, perched on the edge of the sofa knocking knees, cleared their throats. Daisy's mother batted her eyelids a bit until she had everyone's attention.
I don't think discourtesy is called for, she began,
raising her brows and looking past Ruby toward the oil painting of Martin Luther King Jr.
And I doubt that Mr. Patterson's residence is really the bone of contention, as Velma Henry has so clearly put it.
This time, looking past Velma to the golf trophies on the bookshelves.
The issue is, Mr. Patterson, Mr. Riley.
She was nodding to each in turn, a tactic that had once earned her much applause some 10 years ago in a meeting with the city administration, for it bought enough time for Velma and Smitty to leave the room, round up community folks, call the press, and block cutbacks in city services. Daisy Moultrie's mother had been running it into the ground ever since, confused, no doubt, as to why she'd been celebrated in the first place. Velma leaned against the table. Palma sighed and counted the shells on her bracelets. Hamden, next to her, fiddled with the zipper on his cordovan boots, while Velma, distracted, was remembering some absurdly shiny boots back in the days of the marching. Jay Patterson sat down when it was clear that Daisy Moultrie's mother had no intention of relinquishing the floor. He sat down and was almost hidden by the lectern, the clock ticking away over the door, the yet-to-be-delivered speech fat and uncomfortable in his back pocket. Velma sat down too, landing on a soggy wad of paper while the older woman picked up her pace, nodding to each of the women to join her in what turned out to be a fairly monotonous recitative.
Who put your campaign together, Riley, while you and Grace vacationed on Jekyll Island?
Who raised the money for the South Africa ad, composed it, gathered up the signatures and the money, placed it, and absorbed the backlash? Who muzzled the Claiborne Inquirer, got them to squash the smear when your books turned up funny, Hill?
Who saved your ass and never got reimbursed for toll calls, postage, or gas?
Who trudged through dust, through rain, through mud, through the corridors of the Chinese pajamas?
Velma rubbed her forehead and leaned back in her chair. It had been a Gulf station. Of course, she remembered that. The boycott had been still in effect, and she'd felt funny going in there, even if it was just to use the bathroom. Mounting a raggedy tampon fished from the bottom of her bag, paper unraveled, stuffing coming loose, and in a nasty bathroom with no stall doors, and in a Gulf station, too, to add to the outrage, she'd been reeking of wasted blood and rage. They'd marched all morning, all afternoon, and most of early evening to get there. Shot at, spit on, nearly run down by a cement mixer, murder-mouthed, lobbed with everything from stones to eggs, they'd kept the group intact and suffered no casualties or arrests. But when they got to the park, renamed People's Park for the occasion, the host group hadn't set up yet. The banners were still drooping, missing a string in one corner, the PA system only just arriving, and two cables split, the bathrooms locked and boarded up, and no food. No food. Just one lone pot of field peas and chicken backs a couple from the country had hauled up there in their pickup to feed the multitudes. Velma had leaned against a tree and tried hard not to look at her feet. Two pairs of rubber thongs left on the highway. A ragged pair of sneakers abandoned by a lard can and a patch of sunflowers on some railroad crossing. Her reserve pair looped around her neck, feet too swollen to torture further. The marshals dragging themselves around, trying to draw people in from the trees toward the flat truck platform. The children crying from fatigue, the students singing off-key, ragged, the elders on the ground massaging knots in their legs, and Velma clenching her thighs tight, aware that a syrupy clot was oozing down her left leg and she needed to see about herself. Exhausted, she was squinting through the dust and grit of her lashes when the limousines pulled up. Eye stinging shiny, black, sleek, and the door opened, and the cool blue of the air-conditioned interior billowed out into the yellow and rust-red of evening. Her throat was splintered wood. Then the shiny black boots stepping out onto the parched grass, the knife-creased pants straightening taut, the jacket hanging straight, the blinding white shirt, the sky-blue tie. And the roar went up, and the marshals gripped wrists and hoarsely, barely heard, pleaded with the crowd to move back and make way for the speaker. Flanked by the coal-black men in shiny sunglasses and silk and steel suits, he made toward the platform. She carried herself out of the park in search of a toilet, some water to wash up, a place to dump her bag before her arm broke or her shoulder was permanently pulled from its socket. And rounding a bend, the dulcet tones of the speaker soaring out overhead, she'd spotted the Gulf sign and knew beforehand that the restroom would be nasty, that just getting past the attendant would call for a nastiness she wasn't sure she could muster, but would have to. Knew beforehand that she would squat over a reeking, smeared toilet bowl stuffed with everything that ever was and pray through clenched teeth for rain. Some leader. He looked a bit like King, had a delivery similar to Malcolm's, dressed like Stokely, had glasses like Rapp, but she'd never heard him say anything useful or offensive. But what a voice! And what a good press agent! And the people had bought him. What a disaster! But what a voice! He rolled out his R's like the quality yard goods he'd once had to yank from the bolts of cloth in his father's store in Brunswick, Georgia, till the day an anthropologist walked in with tape recorder and camera doing some work on Jackal Island blacks, and would he be so kind as to answer a few questions about the lore and legends of the island folks, and discovered him and launched him into prominence. Leader, shit. And no soap, no towels, no tissue, no machine, just a spurt, then a trickle of rusty water in the clogged sink, then no water at all. And like a cat, she'd had to lick herself clean of grit, salt, blood, and rage. Palma was nudging her, the click click of the cowries reminding her even more of that time, and she blew her turn, someone else taking up the, and who chartered buses for? Matriarchal currency. The sign on the table had read, and she'd purchased the cowrie shell bracelets for Palma less as a memento, more as a criticism. Bought the cowrie shells to shame her, for she should have been on the march, had no right to the cool solitude of her studio, painting pictures of sailboats while sisters were being beaten and raped and workers shot and children terrorized. Divination tools. She had winked at the peddler, who'd been too eager to rap the long rap about cowries and matriarchy. Velma'd warned them that day in the park and for the duration of the march to the state capital to set up tents. Little pussies with stitched teeth, her aide on the PR committee had leered, touching the cowries. And it seemed as good a time as any for her to go draft the press releases. Velma. She stood up again, certain that she was leaving a red-brown smear on the chair. Who's called every time there's work to be done? Coffee made, a program sold, every time some miscellaneous nobody with a 5-minute commitment and an opportunist's nose for a self-promoting break gets an idea, here we go. And we have yet to see any of you so much as roll up your sleeves to empty an ashtray. Everybody gets paid off but us. Do any of you have a grant for one of us? Any government contracts? Any no-work, all-pay posts at a college? Those of you on boards? Is there ever anything you all do on your own other than rent out the Italian restaurant on the Heights to discuss the Humphrey Hawkins bill over wine? And the place is bugged, of course. Ruby, hush. Drinking at the bar is all we've witnessed yet. You all say we need a conference. We book the hotel and set it all up, and y'all drink at the bar. We shuttle back and forth to the airport. Y'all drink at the bar. We caucus, vote, lay out the resolutions. Y'all drink at the bar. We're trying to build a union, a guild, an organization. You are all welcome to continue operating as a social club, but not on our time, okay? Amen. And from now on, when you want some input, don't call us. We'll call you. We'll notify you about the meetings, and you are welcome to join us at my sister's studio, which will be the temporary headquarters of Women for Action until we get a more permanent place. Velma felt Jan's eyes trying to get hers, felt Palma tugging at her dress, but she went on.
You all continue lollygagging at Del Giorgio's, renting limousines and pussyfooting around town profiling in your three-piece suits and imported pajamas while the people sweat it out through hard times. Palma had yanked her down in her chair as Ruby got to her feet.
I heard that, V. You all hear that? We all hear that? Well, this is it, my honeys. We're at the crossroads and are gonna have to decide the shape, scope, thrust, and general whatnot and so forth of this group. Let's take some time out to think it through, and then we'll hear from whoever wants to speak they speak. 2-minute limit, if you please. This is it, the crossroads.
The roads had been washed out. The walkways between the tents were a joke. The children had found dry planks from somewhere and laid them down, but they weren't dry for long or effective. It kept raining and the walkways were mud. Planks too, tents too, everybody caked with red mud. The older women paying it no mind, moving about with slop jars or buckets of fresh water or food like ancient mud mothers from the caves, hair matted and shining with henna, hands red, streaks and slashes across their faces to denote clan kinship. The tents were collapsing, the bed rolls mildewed, the portable toilets had long since not worked. The children on errands in indescribable clothes and barefoot, red mud coming up between their toes like worms, and worms too, many down with fevers, one doctor making rounds, stumbling with sleeplessness and impotence. Velma had gone up to the hotel, her shoes dangling around her neck, the clipboard in the ache of her left arm. She'd hitched, but mostly walked, keeping her eyes strictly off her swollen feet. Gone up to the hotel to make some calls, find another doctor, locate the support group to bring food and aspirin, phone in the press notices, try to locate James's group that had gone to meet up with King in D.C. She was hanging onto the counter with both hands. Nails splitting, hands swollen, the phone too heavy to consider handling without a deep intake of breath and resolve. She could barely stand up, much less focus on the clipboard and flip pages. And behind her, the easy laughter. That familiar voice. Oh, those dulcet tones. And she looked into the mirror. The speaker and his cronies, and the women, those women, coming down the corridor. "I don't want to belabor the point," Velma said, clearing her throat, not sure where they were on the agenda, "and I certainly don't want to antagonize or polarize. Let the chips fall where they may, V."
"Ruby, hush."
"But a review of the history is important if we're to map out with some intelligence and fairness the agenda of the organization. As Ruby said, we're at the crossroads, and what we decide tonight will be decisive. It's not just a matter of who's taken responsibility in the past for carrying out the work, for getting out the press releases, the mailings, for doing the canvassing, for organizing a base among campus forces, street forces, prison forces, workers, gathering the money, arranging for transportation." She was hanging by her nails on the slippery material of the hotel counter, her legs trembling with fatigue, her nose stopped up, her skin caked with mud, her face, her hair dusted with insect wings and pollen. Hanging by her nails, her backbone on fire, her bowels boiling. The switchboard cables, a fabulous Indian rope trick she'd have to deal with to make the calls. The clipboard, a confounding puzzle of glyphs and ciphers, and slanting across the mirror over the key rack, the men without their sunglasses, hair glistening fresh from under stocking caps and fro cloths, the men carrying silver ice buckets and laughing with the women clean and lean and shining, prancing like rodeo ponies, roans, palominos tossing their manes and whinnying down the corridor, and the man who would be leader. Trying not to see them, but seeing them anyway, her eyes swimming in the mirror, slipping and sliding over a field of red silk. No bib overalls, no slop jars here. Just red silk lounging pajamas and silver ice buckets and those women. Losing her grip, the phone too heavy to hold against her ear, her eyes floating in the mirror, skidding over the raised threads that worked out a dragon of white and gold with blazing fangs and fire. Any minute, she'd be a heap on the floor, a puddle of red mud in the carpet but for two hands that were holding her up under her armpits. James? Had he come for her at last? Come to merge the ranks? Someone had broken away, had come crashing through the mirror to lift her, to drag her away, hustle her out of the door. An ice bucket banging her in the knees, the cold stabbing her in the thighs. The shoelaces strangling, her head snapped back in the rush and shove, and all she could see, the landscape of her world, was a blonde hair between green threads on a field of red. Be cool. Palma was patting her, one of the bracelets sliding off into Velma's lap. Don't get overheated, V-girl. Palma was winking, being their grandmother. Be still, girly. Velma ghosted a smile and leaned back, her stocking feet clutching at tufts of the carpet that softened the debate in Patterson's office. Be still, Velma. Just relax now. Ruby was bending with the basin, trying not to bump against the tent, damp with rain. One monkey don't stop no show. Not one, not six. The struggle continues. Haste not, waste not to mention a stitch in time, etc. and so forth. Just get your feet to cooperate and everything'll be just fine. Ruby was trying to put her feet in the basin. Daisy Moultrie was brushing her hair. Velma had no control over her feet, no control over her head either. It seemed to bang around on her shoulders one minute, loll and bob the next. She feared the crony had broken her neck shoving her out of the hotel. But the water was cool. It calmed her. The stroking of her legs was soothing, too, the washcloth soft and fragrant with something Ruby always wore. But Daisy Moultrie was brushing too briskly, and the sparks that flew threatened to ignite her all over again, catch the tent on fire, burn up the stack of flyers waiting on a camp stool for her to distribute. She could hear the crackling wheeze of red silk ablaze. Sister mine, it's a hard row to hoe, but ain't nothing to go out about, Ruby was saying, flinging the water out back, the flap of the tent lifted and moonlight spilling in, the arc of water frozen for an instant, just long enough for her to believe she'd been washed clean of it all. How you feel? Velma? And she wanted to answer Ruby, wanted to say something intelligible and calm and hip and funny, so the work could take precedence again. But the words got caught in the grind of her back teeth as she shred silk and canvas and paper and hair. The rip and shriek of silk prying her teeth apart. And it all came out a growling. Velma. He was out of the booth again, leaning over the table toward her, his jacket hem in her coffee cup. Oh, baby, don't get angry about things over and done with. Come on, let's go home. Growl all you want, sweetheart. I haven't heard a growl like that since Venus moved between the sun and the earth. Not since the coming of the Lord of the Flames. Yes, sweetheart. I haven't heard a good old deep knee bend from the source growl such as that in some 19 million years. Growl on. You gonna be all right. After a while. It's all a matter of time. The law of time, and soon, sweetheart, this will all be yours. You just hold that thought. You hear? 2. Quit wrestling, sweetheart, or you may go under. I'm throwing you the lifeline. Don't be too proud to live.
Speaking of wrestling with pride, men.
What do you say? Minnie Ransom hadn't been aware of her spirit guide's presence or of her own drift elsewhere.
Say she can't hear you, men. Don't even see you. Henry gal off somewhere tracking herself.
Hanging on to hers like trying to maneuver a basket of snakes on a pole. Spasms in every nerve center. And me, I feel like I've been in the middle of a hornet's nest for days. No time to recharge and replenish myself. But talking to docs like talking to sidewalk. He will have his little shows. What's ailing the Henry gal so, old wife? Not that I'm sure I can match her frequency anyway. She's draining me.
Maybe you've met your match, men.
What you say?
Say, she sure is fidgeting like she got the Betsy bugs.
She one of O'Shun's witches, I suspect. What's O'Shun's 2 cents worth on the matter? Maybe she'd like to handle this Henry gal herself.
I don't know about the 2 cents, 'cause I strictly do not mess with haints, men. I've always been a good Christian.
When you gonna stop calling the lower out of their names? They are the laws alive. Seems to me you need to slough off a lot more of the nonsense from this plane if you're going to be any help to me. Some spirit guide.
Leastways I know that O'Shun ain't studying this problem, men, 'cause I hear O'Shun and Oye prettying up to hop a bus to New Orleans. Carnival in this town ain't fancy enough for them. Town. Getting too small for some other proud spirits I could name, too.
Bus? What are you talking about? The lower on some bus?
I'm talking about them haints. They're always up to some trickified business. They ride buses just the same's they ride brooms, peoples, carnival floats, whatever. All the same to them. What they care about scaring people with they ghostly selves?
Then you tell me, old wife, teller of tales nobody much wants to hear any more except this humble servant of a swamp hag, where's the Henry gal gone off to? I don't feel much turbulence in her now.
Swamp hag?
Leaning over to flounce Minnie's dress and jangle her gold bangles, chuckling.
She's off. Dancing, men.
In the mud?
Mud seems to belong to her ways, men.
Dancing in mud with cowries. Twisting and grunting for the reward applause of a bloody head on a tray. Lord have mercy. What is wrong with the women? If they ain't sticking their head in ovens and opening up their veins like this gal or jumping off roofs, drinking charcoal lighter, pumping rat poisons in their arms and ramming cars into walls, they looking for some man to tear his head off. What is wrong, old wife? What is happening to the daughters of the yam? Seem like they just don't know how to draw up the powers from the deep like before. Not full sunned and sweet anymore. Tell me, how do I welcome this daughter home to the world when they all get into acting more and more like
ash potatoes?
Exactly. One in here yesterday whooping and hollering about some hole in a bucket. Took me a good 5 minutes to recall that song, remember?
There's a hole in the bucket, dear Liza, dear Liza. We'll fix it, dear Henry. Like that was a message to go after her husband with a hammer.
I'm telling you, when we started letting these silly children arrange their own marriages without teaching them about compatible energies, about the powers, we made a serious mistake. More mix-match mating going on, enough to make you crazy. Buckets, full-grown women talking about a song told her to hit her husband in the head, like she don't have options. You know what I mean?
I know, excusing the part about the bucket, but course I remember the woman. Course you do. Bless your heart, and thank you. A dormant nerve in the clitoris. No wonder she restless and jumpy with back pains and her legs aching. And no wonder no mating fuel there at all. But like I say, she got options. Just like the Liza in the song, she can just go ahead and fix the fool bucket herself and quit getting so antsy about it. Or she can go find a man that can. Always got options.
Say which?
Options, affirmation and denial. Old no count Henry ain't the only reality. Or she might try affirming his ability to wield a hammer or tote her some water and see what that'll do. How come you squinching up like I'm talking foreign? Ain't you studying at all, old wife?
Well, you know, men, I never was too quick at learning.
Were too. Wisest woman in these parts, bless your heart. Look how you had it all together this morning when that grieving child commenced to sit on my lap and I was about to keel over.
You was about to dump her on the floor, as I recollect.
True, true. But little did I know till you gave me the message that there was more to the wailing than grief.
Message?
You mean you don't remember? You said to check in the floor of the third ventricle. So I did, and zapped a little energy up there near the pineal, good old pineal, and those lavender beams commenced to glow, and she was right as rain.
I said which?
You said malignant ependema. Attempting to take up residence in the base of the brain, men. Old wife, don't you take notes on these sessions? Ain't you getting it all down?
I got all there is to be got, men, excusing a tablet and pencil.
You the beatenest guide I ever heard of. Did you leastways get the drift yesterday when the little honey started singing the Henry Liza Bucket song? Well, anyhow, I don't understand these women sometime. Baby, a man, and then get all in a stiff 'cause he don't know how to fix the hole in the bucket. Sometime original mother is too much the mother, if you know what I mean.
I don't be catching your drift at all much, men. You all wound up today. What's troubling you? It ain't like you to be talking about, are you sure you want to be well? What kind of way is that?
It's these children, old wife. I can handle the dry-boned folks all right. And them generations of rust around still don't wear me any. But these new people and the children on the way in this last quarter, they gonna really be a blip. But the ones pouring into the infirmary are blip enough. Soon's they old enough to start smelling theyselves, they commence to looking for blood amongst the blood, cutting and stabbing and facing off and daring and dividing up and suiciding. You know as well as I, old wife, that we have not been scuffling in this waste-howling wilderness for the right to be stupid. All this waste, everybody all up in each other's face with a whole lot of who struck John, you ain't correct, well, you ain't cute, and he ain't right, and they ain't scientific, and your mama don't wear no drawers, and get off my suede, and he hit me, and she quit me, and this one's dirty, and that one don't have a degree, and on and on.
men.
Don't they know we on the rise? That our time is now? Here we are in the last quarter, and how we gonna pull it all together and claim the new age in our name? How we gonna rescue this planet from them radioactive mutants? No wonder Noah tried to bar them from the ark. Shove over some, old wife. It don't seem polite to poke my hand through you. I need to find some music to get it said. All this madness about to rock me off this stool, old wife.
Not madness throwing rocks at you, men. Best see about yourself.
Well, I'm bearing up, at least. But, old wife, we gonna have to get a mighty large group trained to pull us through the times ahead. Them four horses galloping already, the seven trumpets blasting, and looks like we clean forgot what we come to do. What we've been learning through all them trials and tribulations to do, and it's now. Come in here after abusing themselves and want to be well and don't even know what they want to be healthy for. Lord, the children.
The children are our glory, men.
Amen on that. Wish I had some music to get it out there. These crazy folks need some saying it music.
In our extremity is God's opportunity.
I'll hold that thought, old wife, but get your big buns out the way so I can shuffle through these tapes. Can't seem to find...
What you looking for is in the chapel, men, if you ain't too proud to come and join me there.
If anyone had asked her, not that the master's mind thought to query, or the old-timers would have interrupted, or the visitors dared, or the youth from the teen clinic would, or the staff had ever thought of it, or her guide, or the lower who leaned against the window, witnesses who of course knew, needed to, many Ransom would have had to admit that she was stalling, stalling and failing, her hands resting on Velma Henry's shoulders, silent, and her fingertips still. Over the years, it had become routine. She simply placed her left hand on the patient's spine and her right on the navel, then, clearing the channels, putting herself aside, she became available to a healing force no one had yet, to her satisfaction, captured in a name. Her eyelids closed, locking out the bounce and bang of light and sound and heat, sealing in the throbbing glow that spread from the corona of light at the crown of the head that moved forward between her brows, then fanned out into a petaled rainbow, fanning, pulsing, then contracting again into a single white flame. Just like the corona of the high-tension cables in the old streetcar sheds near the Bible College where day after day, drawn to like a craving, she stared at, strained toward, till one misty night many years later and in another place altogether, a powerhouse in the north, she could finally see it. One misty winter night when Venus beamed down on the corrugated roof at home and Pleiades clustered in the New York sky like the illustration of the double helix taking up so much space in the magazines and papers, she could see it. The light pulsing, the light breaking up and bouncing, swimming together in a rainbow of color, fanning out, and then the pinpoint flame. And she learned to read the auras of trees and stones and plants and neighbors, far more colorful, far more complex, and studied the sun's corona, the jagged petals of magnetic colors, and then the threads that shimmered between wooden tables and flowers and children and candles and birds. On the stool or in the chair with this patient or that, many could dance their dance and match their beat and echo their pitch and know their frequency as if her own. Eyes closed and the mind dropping down to the heart, bubbling in the blood, then beating, fanning out, flooded and shining, She knew each way of being in the world and could welcome them home again, open to wholeness. Eyes wide open to the swing from expand to contract, dissolve, congeal, release, restrict, foot tapping, throat throbbing in song to the ebb and flow of renewal. She would welcome them healed into her arms. Why couldn't it be something usual like arthritis, bursitis, or glaucoma?
Deal with what you're dealt, men.
Calcium, or lymph, or blood uncharged, congealed and blocked the flow, stopped the dance, notes running into each other in a pile-up, the body out of tune, the melody jumped the track, discordant and strident. And she would lean her ear to the chest or place her hand at the base of the spine till her foot tapped and their heads bobbed till it was melodious once more. And often she did not touch flesh on flesh, but touched mind on mind from across the room or from across town or the map linked by telephone cables that could carry the clue spoken. A dream message, an item of diet, a hurt unforgiven and festering, a guilt unreleased, and the charged response reaching ear, then inner ear, then shooting to the blockade and freeing up the flow. Or by letter, the biometric reading of worried eyes and hands in writing, the body transported through the mails. Body, mind, spirit, out of nexus, out of tune, out of line, off beat, off color, in a spin, off its axis, affairs aslant, wisdom at a tangent, and she'd receive her instructions, and turbulence would end. What ought I do about the Henry gal, old wife?
Don't you know?
Don't you? Ain't you omniscient yet, old wife? Don't frown up. All-knowing? Ain't you all-knowing? What's the point of being in all-when and all-where if you're not going to take advantage of the situation and become all-knowing? And all the wisdom of the ages is available to you, isn't that so?
Is. I guess I have all I'm supposed to, men, excusing your ear, begging your pardon. I've been trying to get you to come to chapel for some time, men, and now look like you want to traipse off after the Henry girl and go dancing in the mud. Her pull mighty strong. You best grab hold of that stool you're on and come on to chapel.
I'm coming. Stretching up to pull down the branch where she'll find the exact leaf that will dip just so. Releasing onto her finger the droplet of dew she will roll between thumb and ring finger like a drop of mercury.
Seems to me you are not making the most of your situation, old wife.
You studying?
You? You making the most of your situation, men?
You know, old wife, here lately you getting to be downright Jewish.
Is that right?
Just a little around the edges. I ask you a question, you answer with a question.
For a fact?
Quit funnin', wagging her head and turning toward the break in the trees. The rainbow, lemon, lime, melon, and sherbet pink, arching.
We got a problem here.
I can't quite reach this child, and you keep acting like you dumb as me instead of telling me what to do. Now, suppose you just dig on down into that reticule bag of yours and fish me out a bat bone or some magic root. Chuckling.
You know I don't traffic in such many ransom.
You do, too. Fess up. What you hauling round in that gree-gree sack?
A few personals.
Personals. What you need with personals anymore? Don't they orient you none around here? Didn't they tell you anything?
Why need some they to tell me something when I got you, men?
Okay, I'm gonna hush now, and we gonna concentrate on this growler-scowler Henry gal that's blocking my son. She's good material, you know. We need to get her back into circulation.
I know this. Trouble is, men, she got piss-poor guardians.
Well, don't look at me. I ain't fixin' to die yet just to be her guardian, am I?
Am you witch?
I'm hushing up as of now, 'cause I see you are determined to be raffish. Stepping high over the lemongrass toward the fountain, the cooling spray against her cheek.
Your dress misbehaving, men.
Wind.
Begging your pardon? But wind my foot, you fixin' to mess with that young doctor man behind your corporal body. I seen you casting a voluptuous eye in that doctor man's direction. You fixin' to get into something, man.
Ah, so you are omniscient or clairvoyant one. Leaning against the fountain for a full appraisal of this woman friend who'd been with her for most of her life, one way and then another. Nothing much had changed since she passed. Old wife's complexion was still like mutton suet and brown gravy congealed on a plate. She was still slack-jawed. The hair lip was as deep a gouge as ever. Nothing much to recommend her or to signal she was special. You'd think they'd have fixed that lip. Minnie muttering to herself, sitting down on the ledge she'd built during her apprenticeship. A fountain made from ceramic pipes she'd thought much too lovely to be laid underground conducting sewerage. A pause to view the water, to watch the fishes glinting shots of shine around the pool, the aromas from the right wafting past like a brushstroke in a cartoon. Gardenias, lily of the valley, lavender, cosmos, fuchsia, woolly apple mint, spearmint, and foxglove lush on either side of the chapel's circle doors, bumblebees drunk and swollen, staggering from petal to pistol.
Come.
The journey, though familiar, was not the journey usual. Was like the old times before the gift unfolded, the days when everyone but her daddy was worried crazy about her, running off from Bible college to New York to get sick and be sent home on the train lying down. They called her Batty, fixed, possessed, crossed, in deep trouble. Said they'd heard of people drawn to starch or chalk or bits of plaster, but the sight of full-grown, educated, well-groomed, well-raised Minnie Ransom down on her knees eating dirt, craving pebbles and gravel, all asprawl in the road with her clothes every which way, it was too much to bear. And so jumpy, like something devilish had got hold of her, leaping up from the porch, from the table, from morning prayers, and racing off to the woods, the women calling her back, her daddy dropping his harness and shading his eyes, which slid off her back like slippery saddle soap. The woods to the path to the sweet ground beyond, then the hill, the eating hill. The special dirt behind the wash house. The days when stomping along the path, her shoes in her jumper pocket, stomping to alert the snakes that someone was coming through, she'd encounter old Karen, the old one, Wilder's woman, old wife, the teller of tales no one would sit still to hear anymore. Not when the new tellers could prophesy with such mathematical certainty who would be ill, and who well, who fertile and who sterile, who crazy and who all right, who deserved to live and who was bound to die, and in precisely what manner. And Minnie would slow down, just as she was told, and the older woman would hold her there on the path like a mama cat with gripping teeth.
A full-grown Minnie blocked, it seemed, to the women who hurled warnings at her back by front pew every Sunday spreading no getting around them Karen Wilder hips. Not blocked, but stopped by the thoughts, by the telling, watching the cracked lips slide away as though the teeth had been greased for some finicky photographer, waiting for old wife to speak. Minnie'd be stomping in place, for while it was customarily polite to pause on the path and pass the time of day with neighbor or friend who'd chosen this route over the paved walks or the bus line or the highway, it was customarily safe to keep stomping because the snakes had to be warned people were afoot. So she did as she was told, not even thinking on the snakes people said were not in the woods, but kept clear of the woods as much as possible, and when they didn't, stomped with the best of them. Minnie'd be stock still, finally, while old wife's eyes stared at a spot just above her head where her hair had once puffed up before the New York trip, and stared at the sides of her as though remembering her filled out, young and plump, being sent off to Bible college in Beaufort, held her there, and the greasy teeth finally parting and,
"Not long now, Minnie, and take care,"
coming out, jaws unhinged, looking like a vaudeville dummy. And Minnie'd stumbled off bewildered and spooked, 'cause Karen Wilder, after all, was a teller of strange tales, and who could know then that the message wasn't about death coming to sting her, but about a gift unfolding. Minnie eased away, sleepwalking, till a slither along the side or rustle overhead reminded her to pick them sevens up and plant them down like she had good sense. Sleepwalk, stomping, to the mound, the hill, the special place, the rich, dark earth, the eating dirt that smelled of paprika and curry, smelled of spice and sweet and bitter and sweat from the days when the gypsies had planted their Sarah, their black Madonna, at the crest of that hill, and the community of Sicilians on an adjacent hill turned their black Maria aside, giving Sarah her back. And Minnie, climbing the hill like the Matterhorn or Jacob's Ladder one, her eyes right on Sarah's wooden orbs, not daring to look back behind her toward old wife, felt the old cat eyes a pinpoint of light at the crown of her head. And there, squatting in the dirt at the top of the bluff, still listening, Minnie was told to clear the path that led up to the cliffs, set the trees, fix the rainbow, erect a fountain, and build the chapel in the mind. And going there, the cooling dark, the candles, the altar, she saw the gift and knew, for at least that instant, where the telling came from. And would go back again and again, live there nearly all the time in the days when she had not trusted the gift, when instructions had come, it seemed, from her back teeth as she leaned against the starchy crochets of her parlor chair and let her jaws give into gravity, her tongue resting on the cusp, her lids locking out the banging dance. But what fine radio receivers, dental fillings are, she learned, screening out the waves from mundane sources, police car messages, helicopter traffic signals, then all the CB foolishness, to be available to the waves from the source.
Remember the time you first showed up at a session? I'd been there all along, Min. I keep telling you.
It amused you, some, the animal doctor and all.
Amuses me still.
Grinning with the same greasy teeth after all this time. A vet in Bangor, Maine, had been relaying instructions to a ham operator in Orlando, Florida, who'd sent out an SOS on behalf of his wounded hamster. And Minnie had been well into step three of brewing the remedy tea for her patient until, "Apply poultice warm to hind legs and paws," stopped her in her tracks between the stove and the pantry wall.
"Spun you right up into two jars of ginger peaches."
But I learned to listen and to scream.
You learned to pray some, men. You never been listening too much, just a little around the edges.
Grinning.
But you learned to pray some.
Learning still, old wife. Learning still.
But ain't learned to quit casting a voluptuous eye on the young men's, I'd notice,
chirping her teeth. When you gonna learn, you old stick in the mud, that good ain't got nothing to do with it? They packed me off to seminary thinking helping and healing and nosing around was about being good. It was only that I was available.
I say, men. Begging your pardon. You a blip, old wife. Well, it takes one to know one.
But mostly you a stick in the mud. Turning to watch the young doctor, Dr. Meadows, stroll over toward the stereo where the Loa were setting up. Drums, tambourines, flutes, chekera, gourds, walking right through them.
I swear by Apollo the physician.
Members of the master's mind glancing up at this odd chanting.
By Aesculapius, Hygieia, and Panacea.
Cora Ryder muttering.
And I take witness to all the gods, all the goddesses.
The Loa nudging each other, puffing on cigars and rearing back on their heels.
To keep according to my ability and my judgment, the following oath.
Quiet. Mr. Daniels dropped hands to wheel around from the prayer circle to jab Dr. Meadows in the chest.
That's no proper kind of prayer,
Cora Ryder muttered hoarsely, making it clear to all within ear and eyeshot that nothing a red bone said or did could be anywise proper.
Shush. Shush nothing. Coming in here with all that superstitious hocus-pocus like the good woman Ransom is some Count Damn Dracula he got to protect his marin hisself from.
Cora, if you please. Minnie sliding her palms down her thighs and winking at her companion. No, good ain't got a blessed thing to do with it, old wife.
Which it?
Any of it. Now here I am, and there I am, and all I am, free to be anywhere at all in the universe, and where I choose to be in just a little while is on my front porch, having a nice tete-a-tete over tea with that Dr. Meadows, who would, I'm sure, be most interested in learning about the ancient wisdoms, the real, the actual, the show-enough original folk stuff behind them Greek imposters he's calling up, and they're already there, right there in the treatment room, if he'd only see.
Begging your pardon, men, but you color struck.
Anywhere at all in the universe, but I choose to be here with this growler scowler, and good ain't the key. It's just that I'm available to any and every adventure of the human breath.
You always were one for capers, men.
But just look at that child's face. And I bet she had parents that told her, grandparents, I'm sure, that God don't like ugly.
God like it all, men. Just a frowning and contorting up her face, a divine creation, the human face, and just look at her, one rough customer, that one. Just like you for the world, men.
I ain't studying you, old wife, hunkering down among the flowers by the chapel doors. But I'll tell you this, the face is a wondrous thing. You can go anywhere at all with a human face, journey straight into the fifth kingdom of souls, if that's your pleasure.
Say which?
You heard me. The fifth. Seems to me, old wife, that by now you should so well know all these things, you'd have things to tell me. You've been dead long enough.
There is no age nor death in spirit, men. Besides, I do tell you things soon's they come to me.
Where from? I've been asking you that for years. You don't explain things clearly, old wife.
You don't listen good, men. Or maybe it's me. I never was too bright.
When I was a young girl, I thought you were the wisest.
You thought I was crazy as a loon.
Well, what with never combing your hair and coming to church in men's overshoes and talking to snakes and things, you were crazy as could be. But I used to watch you slip up alongside you in the tobacco sheds and listen to you hum and talk, 'cause I knew you were special.
You said I smelled, men.
Well, you did smell. Of dirt and gumbo and wintergreen and nasty salves and pitch. Girl, you smelled of everything, but so wise. You had a way of teaching us kids things.
Y'all called me a witch.
True, but for goodness sake, we were just foolish little creatures, no more than 11 or 12 then. Later on, I wasn't too much the fool. I didn't learn to listen to you.
Didn't.
Did too. So quit pouting. Remember how me and Sophie and Serge and Cleotis would hang around your candy stand?
Messing with my papers and trying to steal the pennies.
Naw, now. We used to like to hear you and Wilder talking over the old days and things like that. I know you know that, or you wouldn't have been telling us kids things to do and think about and read and check out and reach for. We couldn't have grown up without you, old wife. None of us.
We going in the chapel, or you plan to talk these here flowers to death?
It seemed to Dr. Julius Meadows, leaning against the desk, chagrined, playing with the buttons of the stereo, that the right hand of the healer woman was on its own, that she had gone off somewhere and left it absent-mindedly behind on the patient's shoulder, and it seemed that the patient was elsewhere as well. So like the catatonics he'd observed in psychiatric, the essential self gone off, the shell left behind. Dr. Meadows ran a hand through his hair, and it crackled as though there were a storm brewing outside the window. He gazed out, wondering where Catatonia was, if it might be in the woods behind the infirmary. Wondered if the two women had arranged a secret rendezvous in the hills, and if going there he would find them both transformed, the older woman in full lotus under a blanket like the weathered photos his roommate had brought back from India, the younger, a laurel bush, as in some legend, blooming in pieces somewhere in storybook memory. He wanted to leave. But how to go without telling himself he was on a fool's errand,